some people win, some people lose. And so, yeah, the longer your training is, the better a deal it is for you. It's basically a subsidy on long training and depressed salaries, because at least for a neurosurgeon, they're going to have a good return on the investment of time for their extra training.
Welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Today, I have a really exciting guest, Dr. Ben White, who is one of the few people in the student loan world that I think knows as much as me, maybe even a little more on some things, for sure. So, Ben, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so maybe you can start off just by sharing a little bit about why our listeners should trust you and how you got involved in the student loan world in the first place.
Well, everyone should always be skeptical, but so for me personally, I have been writing online at benwhite.com since 2009, and I'm a physician who graduated from medical school in 2012. So I was able to see all the various changes that have happened in the various programs throughout kind of modern student loan history, from PSLF and IBR, pay-as-you-earn, repay, the whole thing, the whole nine yards. And because it was important to me as a medical student, I started looking into these topics and trying to teach myself. And back at that point in time, in the dark ages of the internet, there was basically nothing good out there about the topic. So if you Googled something back in 2009 or 2010, all you got was crickets, occasionally some forum posts. It was pretty much empty. And so I tried to teach myself. And then when I learned what I needed to know, try to teach other people as well.
That's pretty good. And so in 2012, like one thing that I've found is it seems like a lot of medical students started getting access to borrowing exclusively direct loans in 2008.
That's correct.
You know, in 2010 is when everybody got access to it. So maybe you can talk a little bit about why that would be the case for some people.
You know, it was basically around the time of the housing crisis in 2008. But at that point, the private lenders essentially pulled out of financing medical students for whatever reason. And so the direct loan program took over everything. So every medical student from my year and beyond stopped getting FFLE loans, stopped getting private loans for quite a while. And really, the private industry did not come back in and step in and start loaning again until several years later. So everyone graduating in 2012 and on was basically just pure direct loans, which means that all those people, without making special steps, were also going to end up being eligible for PSLF if they got the proper kind of job afterwards.
Now, I see plenty of FFPL loans in 2008 and 2009 for other professions. Is there any particular reason why med school is special in that regard?
You know, I don't know, except for the fact that the amounts borrowed were quite high. And I remember as a student, even in 2008, that everyone a year ahead of me had loans from Bank of America or, you know, from various private lenders that were, again, you know, guaranteed by the government. But no one in my class did. It just wasn't even an option. The student loan office just told us what we got, what we did. And it was all just the way it was. And I'm actually not sure why other industries were still doing that at that point, because the direct program at that, during, you know, my tenure was already expanded and it was kind of ready for those borrowers. So I'm not quite sure why doctors were different.
Yeah, that is interesting. I wonder if it does have to do with the amount borrowed being kind of the key ingredient there.
I suspect so.
Do you think that people who started in, say, 2004, I mean, and finished in 2008, or people who started in 2006 who finished in 2010, I mean, most of those people, I think I've seen them with mostly FFEL loans. Is there some sort of thing about if you've already started borrowing with that type of loan system, they let you finish it? Or
I don't think so. I think those people actually did switch over. At my school, everyone switched over. I don't know if some other schools, maybe some private schools, may have had some different arrangements. And some schools also have a much bigger infrastructure for kind of private local school loans as well, where people can borrow kind of things from the local medical society and whatnot. But at my institution, everyone switched over during my year in 2008, 2009.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So, you know, let's talk about the PSLF program in general. So, you know, you have FFEL loans, which existed prior to 2010. And clearly, there was sort of a messy implementation between when this PSLF program got passed in 2007 and 2010, when everybody basically had to take out direct loans and you couldn't have ineligible loans anymore. I was thinking about this and I wanted to get your take on this. So one of my thought processes on how all this happened is in 2007, Congress wanted to do PSLF, but they passed it in a very limited scope because only about 20% of the loans overall were direct loans back then. And so you had this very limited scope. And then in 2010, PSLF got expanded by forcing everybody to have the right kind of loans that qualified. Some articles that I've read out there have talked about how that's actually kind of not what the original Congress intended in terms of the breadth of the program. And so that's one of the reasons why the program got so horribly implemented, is because there was kind of a disagreement when it first got passed. into how big they wanted it to be. And I felt like this could maybe kind of tie into kind of what was going on with the ACA around that same time, where you had the huge involvement of private insurers in this government healthcare program, because that was the political reality of what they had to do. So I'm wondering, like, how much do you blame the lack of PSLF acceptances on sort of political dysfunction, and how much do you blame borrowers?
Yeah, I think, you know, for those early years, you kind of had to be extremely proactive to have possibly taken the correct steps, because the guidance was basically missing, you know what I mean? So in terms of the FIFO loans, you know, most borrowers, you read the news stories, right? You know, they were calling in saying they wanted to do PSLF, but at that point, we didn't even have ECF forms yet. You know, people had no idea what to actually do. They just thought that if they did the right thing, it would all work out, which when it comes to government work is probably not a good outlook to have. And so people made a mistake. I do think overall that it is kind of, you know, the government's fault to a certain extent. It's the usual thing where they pass a kind of broad law and then it gets in committee and people have to kind of hash out the details. But the details are what everything hinges on. And we've seen time and time again where people have taken a common sense approach to the issue and it has not worked out in their favor, because it's not about common sense. It's about the details.
Yeah, and that's why people read your blog and ours.
Exactly.
It's because of the details. So 1.1 million borrowers have been approved for PSLF with a, you know, an ECF form, which is employment certification form. It basically just means that, yes, you've made at least one payment that counts towards the 120 total that you have to do to get your loans forgiven. And so we've only had about 1,200 people out of 100K that have actually been approved. So that's a 1% acceptance rate. You know, to me, that kind of makes sense because of, you know, maybe 20% of the federal loans were direct around that 2007 to 2010 timeframe. And then of those people that had the direct loans, my thought process on that is maybe as few as 5 to 10% of those people that had direct loans were probably on an income-based plan of some sort. You know, is that sound about right? Or would you differ on those stats, like 5 to 10% of all the direct, you know, loan folks prior to 2010 being on an IDR plan?
Yeah, it sounds plausible. I haven't done the math, but when you think about the ICR plan that was available that qualified, you know, most people at that point were going to end up being on graduated or extended, because their monthly payments were actually going to end up being lower on those plans than they would have been on ICR. So most people would not have been even on the crappy, you know, IDR plan at that point, unless they were being kind of proactive and clever. Again, I had a bunch of attendings when I was a resident, you know, who I would talk to and be like, I think I qualify. And I'd be like, you probably don't. Based on your age, I sincerely doubt it. And now I talk to them and we look at their stuff. And, you know, lo and behold, they were always either had FIFO loans. And if they didn't have that, they were still usually on the wrong plan. They had been on graduating or extended, because most people were not in ICR. And so I do think it's one of those things where, you know, those first few years are super hairy in terms of the details. You really had to do a lot of good things proactively with minimal guidance to have all your ducks in a row. Whereas when you get to my year, you know, I had all direct loans. IBR existed at that point. So all you got to do is pick a plan that's going to be the plan that seems the best one for you anyway, and just make your payments. So it's going to get so much easier over time.
Right. And that kind of gets lost in a lot of the scare tactic headlines to get a lot of clicks that people like to run. So if I kind of extrapolate that, so 20% of federal loans prior to 2010 were direct loans. 5 to 10% of that is probably on an income-driven plan. And so 5% times 20% is 1%, right? So 1% right now is the acceptance rate for PSLF. So the math really does make sense as to why the acceptance rate is so bad. To break out some of the reasons for rejection, and we'll ask you your thoughts on each of these. If you sum up the reasons for rejection, really almost all of them, about 94% of the reasons for rejection come down to three things. 55%, it was having qualifying payments, so you weren't signed up for an IDR plan. 24% was missing information. So that's like people not putting a signature of their employer on there, just submitting the stuff without the right signatures. And 15% not having eligible loans. So in other words, they were on an IBR plan, but they had the wrong kind of FFEL loans. The other reasons are really pretty minuscule. Very few people submitted forms with ineligible employers. Very few people submitted forms that had employment dates that were not correct. So really, it's having those eligible loans that's causing so many problems right now. So what are your thoughts on those rejection rates? And also, you have the false positive signal where the only people that are getting rejected right now are the people that think they qualify but don't, or at least that's the majority of the people that are applying, right? Like if you know that you're not eligible, you're not applying for PSLF. in the first place. So like, you know, naturally you're having probably a disproportionately misinformed person that's applying in the first place, making these statistics look so awful. Would you have any thought about that?
Yeah, it's kind of like a Dunning-Kruger effect, right? Where there are known unknowns and there are unknown unknowns. And so people who are novices are much more likely to overestimate their talents. And so, yeah, I think a lot of people applying early didn't know that they didn't qualify because they weren't paying attention, which is not a good sign. I think some of them probably did know they didn't qualify, but they're just kind of hoping, right? You know, they're trying to get some paperwork in there. You never know, right? What's the harm? I've been making these payments for 10 years. Worst thing that happens, I get denied, right? No big deal. And I also think that part of it comes from the qualifying payment number. It also comes from just administration issues, right? So some people are probably doing their own math and saying, hey, I got 120 payments. I'm ready to apply. But meanwhile, FedLoan has not counted 120 payments for either correct or wrong reasons. And because people tend to fight with FedLoan on an annual basis for getting their payment count correct, if you never did it before, especially if you're waiting until year 10 to submit your ECFs for your entire tenure, you can imagine that all it takes is one thing to be wrong. You can be off by one payment and you're still going to be denied, right? So, you know, it doesn't take a lot for people to be off by a month or two over the course of 10 years. And so I think some of those people on reapplication probably would be close to getting it. They just never did the math up front and never had FedLoan on board up front to confirm that they were actually going to be at the right target when they applied.
Yeah. So one of the things I've thought about is how to estimate how much forgiveness is coming down the pipeline, right? And so if you look at the numbers, 2013 is the first year that we have data for how many people, or how much loans rather, were on an IDR plan and were direct loans. So in other words, loans that could possibly qualify for PSLF, right? And so in 2013, that number was $72 billion. And then in 2019, that number is $450 billion. So you've gone from loans that were eligible for PSLF in 2013 were this 70-something billion-dollar number. And then in 2019, it's about almost six or seven times that amount. And so, you know, like you said, you're the first cohort of people that could have been eligible without having to have done anything special ever, really. I mean, unless you were just a genius with consolidation, you know, in 2010. Was that even a thing? Like, was it possible to consolidate your loans into direct loans in 2010? Or was it just a really complicated process?
No, it was. I think it was still on paper back then, but you could do it. But, you know, I'll tell you, even if you went to your student loan counselor, you know, at school and you did your exit counseling, whatnot, they didn't recommend it usually. They didn't really know what was going on. So I don't think most people would have ever done it unless they just thought it looked nice. You know, if you're like, I don't want to have, you know, eight loans or 10 loans, you could count Perkins or something like that. They would have said, cause, you know, I had a subsidized loan, an unsubsidized loan for every semester back then, Perkins loan. You could have, you know, 15, 16 loans over the course of school, right? And so I think some people were like, that looks messy to me. I just want to have one loan. And so I think those people may have consolidated. But other than that, there wasn't really a big reason to. I don't think people really understood that if you consolidated your FIFA loans, you could make them eligible. That wasn't like part of the PSLF, you know, broadcast. And by the way, guys, if you're a current borrower, you're doing it wrong, do this simple thing right now and you'll be set for life. That was not broadcast at all.
Yeah. And I think that that's the reason why you have such a low number. Even, I mean, in 2013, I mean, think about 2013, they had Pay-as-you-earn at that point was around. IBR had been around for 4 years. The ECF form had been around for 1 year. And you're still at a point where out of the $1 trillion of federal student loans, you only had $72 billion on an IDR plan. So even that, you know, reason, I mean, really, frankly, is showing you why there were so many Obama student loan forgiveness scams back then, partly because people hadn't really reacted yet. You know, $72 billion, 7% of loans on an IDR plan, that is tiny. You know, and so today we have about 30% of federal loans or direct loans on an IDR plan, and that percentage is only going to increase over time. You know, one thought about this, that direct loans on an IDR plan is basically right now growing at around a 10% rate. So you would expect that number to double in 10 years, right? So should be $900 billion, say 10 years from now, based off of that current rate of growth. If you think about that, maybe about 25% of the federal workforce, I think, has been estimated to be eligible for PSLF. 25% of, you know, $450 billion is like 110, 112 million or 112 billion, something like that. And so then, you know, if you just divide that by 10, maybe you can get a back of the napkin estimate of 10 to 11 billion a year of PSLF forgiveness. And maybe in 2013, you're talking more like 25% of 70 something billion. Maybe that's like 15 to 20 billion divide that by 10, you're talking like 1 billion. So if you work your way back, you know, maybe like a 50-ish million, 100 million, 200 million type number is very plausible until you get into the mid-2020s where you would see single billions of dollars forgiven. And then that number would continue to exponentially grow where you could really see it being the size of the annual budget of NASA, I think, within a few years after that. I mean, what are your thoughts on the timetable of PSLF and the exploding cost of it?
Yeah, I think once you're getting to, you know, 2022, kind of 2021, you know, especially the mid 2020s, that's when things explode. And when you realize that no matter what the political gridlock is, there's going to have to be a change, not necessarily in that program specifically, but in the overall way we finance and fund higher education, because it's already kind of, you know, pretty much a crisis, you know, a $1.4 trillion, you know, industry of lost opportunity for young Americans. And so now we're going to be in a situation where the optics are going to be painful, right? It's going to be big tax cut equivalents continuously. But instead of being tax cuts for the wealthy, quote unquote, it's going to end up being basically an entitlement for young Americans who are trying to deal with this. And what it's really doing is, you know, having unlimited federal loans and having basically unlimited tax-free forgiveness in the right circumstance is basically just funding runaway super inflationary tuition growth. And so that's not sustainable. And so I think if nothing else, the PSLF bomb that's going to go off is going to cause everyone to look even more carefully about how we're funding college. Because I think the main problem isn't so much the forgiveness, so much as the cost.
Yeah, that's a good point. And some of the things that I've written about that problem in particular, be interested to hear your thoughts on this. So, you know, for a primary care physician, PSLF is going to cost a lot more than for a specialist because that primary care physician is going to hit that level of having to pay based on an attending income much sooner. Whereas, you know, a neurosurgeon might only be paying on a neurosurgeon level salary for maybe 1 year, 1 or 2 years after training. And so you could see a case where a neurosurgeon pays $50,000 for their loans and gets that massive income after training. And then your primary care doctor pays maybe half of the cost of their loans. You know, so that's obviously a big difference. And then, so that's one thing I'd like your reaction to.
Yeah. So I think that's going to be the New York Times story that comes out in a couple of years will be that exact story, right? It'll be somebody who is probably earning about a seven-figure salary. They'll find somebody who's doing it. They'll find somebody who's making $1 million and show you how he got, you know, private college and private med school forgiven. So he'll have, you know, $500,000 forgiven while he's, you know, buying a Bentley. I don't know why someone's going to give this interview, but I think it's going to happen and it's going to look really bad. And it's going to be used as a ploy to, you know, stoke outrage, but also to talk about how the program is broken because it has no means testing. At the end of the day, we are going to see things like that happen, right? Because, you know, whenever there are rules, whenever there are technicalities, people will exploit the rules and technicalities to make the most of it for themselves. And so if you make a rule that it works like this, some people win, some people lose. And so, yeah, the longer your training is, the better a deal it is for you. It's basically a subsidy on long training and depressed salaries, because at least for a neurosurgeon, you know, they're going to have a good return on the investment of time for their extra training. It's less good for some other doctors, right? Like, let's say you're, you know, you're a pediatric endocrinologist, and so it's 3 years of residency and 3 years of fellowship. It's 6 years, pretty long training. They, on average, make less than a primary care doctor. And so for those people, you know, yes, they're subsidized a little bit in the sense that their loans can be forgiven. They'll pay less on their loans because of their long training. But overall, their salary is not going to go up from the training. So it helps kind of mitigate the cost, the opportunity cost of that training. It's not going to make it a good deal, though. So there is a plus and minus that, right? You know, in some ways, there are certain professions within medicine that this does make doable, or at least more palatable, because it does help get rid of some of the more painful pinch points and costs. But yeah, the thing with neurosurgeons and people who have long training like that, who do come out with high salaries, it looks bad.
One thing I'd say is that story will probably be in the Wall Street Journal and not the New York Times.
That's true. That's true.
But another thing that I've found very interesting is there's this huge trend towards very wealthy medical schools going zero tuition or almost no tuition, right? So you have NYU famously came out with free med school tuition, and then the local med school, Washington University in St. Louis here, has announced that they're going to be doing that for a lot of their incoming class. And so the troubling trend that I've seen is they announce that they're doing this to increase diversity in primary care practitioners. And then what they do, at least especially in the case of NYU, is they limited the class size to cause even higher MCAT score people to apply so they can rise in the rankings. And then if you have even higher MCAT scores, that's correlating to having much higher USMLE scores that are going to help place you into residencies. You're going to have a ton of people placing into neurosurgery and orthopedic surgery and all these super high paying fields, and you're going to probably have fewer primary care folks, not more. And so then if you look at the benefit of free tuition, given that so many of these folks, you know, would have gone into the nonprofit field, are going to have most of their loans forgiven anyway, really this is a benefit to extremely intelligent people who are going to come to these top performing med schools and then go into private practice and have no loans as a result of it. It's not at all subsidizing diversity and primary care and things like that. It's just a patent attempt at rising the med school rankings. Do you agree or disagree with that? What are your thoughts?
I think that's probably largely right in terms of its practical effect. You know, I do think there is at least some lip service to the idea that we're hoping to get people who don't have family help in, and depending on how they structure their admissions process, they could probably do that. But in terms of getting people to do primary care, yeah, it doesn't work that way. You're never going to fix the problem of, you know, healthcare distribution in this country, both in specialty or in location, with kind of supply side issues on cost. At the end of the day, you know, every doctor has a decent living, and, you know, overall, except for the most kind of heinous of private schools, you're going to be okay in the long run if you have a full-time job afterwards. So the main issue here is the prestige of the field, the work environment the field is in, you know, all those issues, lack of autonomy, the kind of 15-minute med check, you know, overly complex patient boondoggle that a lot of people in primary care have seen and are rallying against. That's the problem with primary care. It's not going to be because it doesn't pay enough. You know, at the end of the day, that's not going to solve that problem. The way you solve that problem is going to be a much more complex on kind of how healthcare is practiced. And that's a hard problem to solve. So I can appreciate why a school might be like, oh, we can do this. We can address the cost issue. But the cost issue is really not the issue. It's other factors about how healthcare is provided in the country that are really kind of distressing.
So we have a lot of people besides physicians listening to this podcast, like dentists, lawyers, veterinarians, chiropractors, folks that are going to be relying on the 20 or 25 year version of forgiveness where you have to pay income taxes on the forgiven balance instead of the 10 year version where there's no income taxes. Some of these rules seem like they're straightforward, but they're really not. And this is an example I want to give you. One thing that a lot of people have talked about is, okay, well, we can do the repay plan and get our subsidy on our interest for 19 years, right? Year 19, even though repay is a 25-year plan, I'm going to stop on a dime at year 19 and I'm going to switch to the pay-as-you-earn plan, and then all my loans are going to be forgiven. And I'm going to have a smaller balance forgiven because I got the subsidy. Now, interested to hear your thoughts on paper that works.
Yeah.
But we never recommend that because I think it's going to fail pretty badly because I think, one, the loan servicers are not going to be able to track that very well. And then two, I think that most of the reform plans that I've seen, or a lot of the ones that I've seen, basically lock people into their current plan. I mean, I think that the Prosper Act might have done that. I can't remember off the top of my head, but some of these different reform proposals seem to basically say, okay, whatever plan you're in, when we pass this new bill, you're stuck in it. You're not going to go from, you know, repay to pay, pay to repay, IBR, all this stuff. Your only option will be to get off the old plan and move on to the new one. What are your thoughts? You think that's going to actually happen? Like, do you think that people will get locked into the plan that they're on, or that you're going to be able to perpetually switch between them?
You know, on paper, that definitely works. I've actually written about that before. It makes perfect sense. I think if they were to try to close that, and the Prosper Act proposal did try to fix that, you know, I think, again, that's probably the kind of thing that's going to be only applying to new borrowers. I don't think they're going to be able to say you can't switch plans, because even on your MPN, on your master promissory note, it gives you the plans that are available to you. So I don't think they're able to change the rules of the game retroactively for those people who have the ability. Now, I do think you're asking a lot of the servicers to do a good job, and there's no guarantee they're not going to make things very difficult for you in that process. That being said, we're talking about the future, you know, 20 years down the line. So, you know, who knows? I think probably just as likely as that plan not working is the idea that we just make all that forgiveness tax-free, right? That's been proposed. Even Warren has proposed that in the past, that we should just make all that forgiveness tax-free, and that somebody who is, you know, knowing that tuition is high and debt is high, that the practical matter, we can't expect people who are making these negatively amortizing payments, you know, throughout their careers to suddenly be able to knock out a tax bomb. I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm not really sure it will, but I think it's definitely a possibility that we see some big structural changes over the course of the future about that. You never know.
Well, so one thing that FedLoan is pretty much telling people to do at a structural level is if somebody's married and does not have student loans with their spouse, then they're telling them to check the box, like, I can't access my spouse's income and do repay. Because basically, from what I can tell, all the servicers have the same script. Every time, do repay, revise pay as you earn, no matter what. It makes sense because everybody's eligible for it with direct loans. So they can tell all the loan servicers, all the phone reps, they can tell them all the same thing, which is why I think that that's why it's trended towards that direction. And then obviously repay, you can't file separately, but you can on pay as you earn. And I think that's just too complicated of a concept for the phone reps to explain or want to explain. So that's why they're telling them to check this box. And what's interesting is I heard a rumor that Navient had the Department of Ed reach out to them and say that they're not allowed to do that anymore. Stop doing that. But FedLoan continues to do it. So I'm really not hearing that a ton from people that have their loans at Navient, and I'm hearing it all the time for people that have their loans with FedLoan. I was just wondering if you've heard anything like that.
Yeah, I'm still hearing it about FedLoan, although not as much in the past month or two. But yeah, I mean, they've been telling borrowers to commit fraud, basically. They've been saying to use this box. You know, even people who were on pay as you earn, who are filing separately as appropriately, FedLoan was still telling those people to check the box when they didn't have to at all. They could just, they did everything right already. They had nothing else to do except for submit their form, and their forms were being denied and told to resend with the box checked, which is just wrong. And so I don't know why they're doing that. I think it's kind of, you know, blatantly false and misleading. And I think it's probably just them being inept, but it is kind of troubling because you could foresee in a dystopian world where people fit that box because they're being told to, and then later on are denied because they committed fraud, right? Like, oh, we can't process these payments because you checked the wrong box. That was not true. And I don't think it's that nefarious. I really don't, but it is a problem and people should stop doing it because they're getting bad advice. So if you do get that advice from somebody, don't follow it. Ask for a supervisor, because somebody at somewhere will eventually say, you're right, you don't have to do that.
And that's just the concern that I have, is even sometimes the supervisors don't even know what they're doing. I mean, it's just really terrible all around. In terms of some more controversial strategies, so there's some thoughts about double consolidation of Parent Plus loans, where basically you take your loans, and theoretically, I think you would do this on paper first. So you would send in two paper applications to consolidate to two different servicers and create two direct consolidation loans. And then online, you go in and you submit a consolidation online to take those two direct consolidation loans and turn them into a new consolidation loan that's now eligible for things like revised pay-as-you-earn. And previously, it was only eligible for ICR. So that's something that you think is okay based on the PROSPER Act, correct?
Yeah. So, you know, this is something people do for Parent Plus loans, basically. You know, I never personally had anyone I've talked to do that, because most people I speak to are a little bit younger. But the fact that it was a loophole the PROSPER Act wanted to close tells you that it's a real loophole, because otherwise they wouldn't have any reason to close it. So it's clearly a workable solution. It's one of those kind of absurd ones where, you know, why would two consolidations magically make the, you know, intrinsic loans fall away? Probably just a bug in the computer system, honestly, right?
Yeah.
But here we are. But so yeah, it has to be a real loophole, because the PROSPER Act specifically wanted to close it.
We try to really direct more people in that situation towards ICR, even though they're going to pay more. We tell them how to do the double consolidation, but, you know, we're kind of not comfortable taking on that task directly, because that really would involve taking paper applications for consolidation and really filling them out for people and submitting them. And that's just something that I've never really wanted to do as a business. It just does not feel right. It feels like that's something that could get you into trouble. So we like to try to tell people how to do it. If they want to do it, they can, or you can just do the ICR path, which is the more straightforward path.
Yeah, Parent Plus is, yeah, I mean, thankfully it's a going away problem over time, I think. So, you know, there are better ways to deal with this issue of funding education than for a parent to kind of mortgage their own retirement with a Parent Plus loan. It's a problematic system.
But can you imagine, like, so the market for grad school is, you know, several hundred billion dollars or something like that, but the market for undergrad is much bigger than that. And can you imagine what would happen if you could do the repay plan, and imagine if you had the pay plan available for Parent Plus loans? So all you got to do is pay 10% of your taxable income for 20 years and it's gone. If really parents understood what that meant, then every parent in America would save absolutely nothing for college, or at least anybody below like $100,000 in income, because you could borrow an unlimited amount. And if you're retiring, you're probably going to be not paying hardly anything, because 10% of your taxable income when a lot of it's Social Security, you'd pay nothing. So I wonder if that Parent Plus rule is going to change, or if it's going to stay as convoluted as it currently is. you know.
I definitely wanted to address that. The Prosper Act has something called, I can't remember the name of it offhand, but it was a direct one loan. They were calling, they had given it a new name.
Federal one.
Federal one. And so the idea was that you could have a federal one loan or you could have a federal loan that included a parent plus loan, because they know that even with trying to simplify the rules, they had to treat parent plus especially different because it is such a kind of potential time bomb situation if they handled it improperly, because it is, it's a difficult issue.
What about doing amending tax returns from separate to joint to get the penalty back? The theory being that you just wait to do that until you're no longer using that tax return and your most recent tax return is always separate, but the old one you can amend to joint after you've submitted with the new tax return.
That part I find unsettling a little bit. I really do. I mean, again, technically speaking, I don't think it's, you know, runs afoul of anything currently in the way forgiveness is processed right now. They would never know. So I think it would probably be okay, but that seems very disingenuous. And, you know, I think I'm all for people exploiting the technicalities of the rules to make sure that they're doing the right thing in terms of maximizing their benefits. But I do think that one probably is over the line, is my personal feeling. And I can see a world in where you could get burned on that if they want to. That's something that I think they could enforce retroactively and not run afoul of lawsuits.
Yeah, honestly, we're starting to kind of explore that and recommend that to clients, just because, you know, in talking with some people, enrolled agents, like various people, it's kind of like, as long as you used everything the right way at that time, you know, technically you didn't do anything wrong.
And I agree. It definitely on paper, again, should be fine. And the benefit of that particular loophole versus, let's say, you know, switching plans at year 19 is that that one's on you, right? And that one's between you and the IRS. That's a much more functional relationship, the one between you and the servicer. So yeah. that's guaranteed to work, quote unquote. You know what I mean? So, you know, by all means, I don't think it's wrong. I don't want to say that. It is clearly a very clever thing to do.
Well, it's aggressive. And the thing is a lot of clever things are legal. Like, you know, is it legal to stuff a bunch of privately held shares for a non-publicly valued small company stock, right? Or private stock that you own in your family, right? And you're valuing it at $10 million when the true value is probably more like 20 or 30 if you actually sold it, but your accountant says it's legal to do that and you stuff it all in there and you're in your trust, and then the trust grows from 10 million to, you know, $1 billion over the course of 40 years when you give it to your heirs and you give it to them without paying a dime of death tax or estate taxes, right? So it's one of those things that's aggressive and maybe it could go away, but probably should work, I think. What about the distribution of income in community property states? We call it the breadwinner loophole, basically taking the 200K earner and splitting the income 50-50, 100K and 100K on each.
That's totally a real thing. And even the feds have realized that and they acknowledge it. It is what it is. And in fact, if you have the reverse situation where you are the low income earner, you can actually still ask to be considered with pay stubs instead.
Which is fascinating, isn't it?
So if you're on the wrong side and your, you know, spouse is bringing you up too high because you are forced to do that, even if you're, you know, in pay as you earn, filing separately, is you can say, please use my pay stubs. Obviously, you won't get deductions from retirement contributions and stuff like that because you have to use pay stubs for that. But you can, in fact, kind of take it both ways. So it's actually a very interesting situation. I'm from Texas, so that's relevant to me, or it was. It's a valid loophole and it's one that they acknowledge.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that people that hire us miss the most often.
Yeah.
So, I mean, virtually anybody in like Louisiana, Texas, draw the line all the way to California, right? New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, California, Washington State, Idaho, Alaska. Anybody that's in those states, almost certainly, that's going for loan forgiveness is probably making a big mistake with how they're doing things because it's pretty complicated. What about the IDR form now? Asking if your income decreased versus has it significantly changed. I know you used to feel like it was a little bit of a gray area if you didn't report your attending income, but now it seems pretty obvious that that's exactly how you're supposed to do it, is not.
Yeah, they changed it, which is actually fantastic. Yeah. For a long time, I used to advocate people to kind of be cognizant of when they filed their certifications. They were able to be truly honest with that statement because it used to say, has it changed? And that's, what does that mean, right? Whereas now it's very clear, it's decreased. I actually just updated my books because it actually makes things more simple. It's one of those rare situations where a lot of the hand-wringing people had is gone because that question is now very easy to answer. It's great.
Yeah, so another kind of interesting thing, we did a survey of our readers for refinancing. And one of the questions we asked is, we said, assume you have a private loan and you have the opportunity to refinance it for a $500 bonus, one-time bonus, and there's no interest change at all. It's the same interest rate. Would you do that? And about, I think about 2/3 of people said that they would do that. You know, so that's, it's a pretty high level of people that said they would do that. But then we asked, you know, assuming you have, you know, a loan that you've already refinanced, how much better of a interest rate would you need to get to be willing to do it again? And the majority of people, I think, said a rate that was like over 1.5% or 2% or something, something unbelievable, right? So if you have a $50,000 loan, if you get a 1% lower rate, that's going to save you, simplified math, but like, you know, $500-ish for the first year, and it's going to save you money every year thereafter. So what are your thoughts there? Are just people just like totally bad at math and like, yeah, they don't understand?
I think so.
Yeah, like that blew my mind. I'm just like, these are smart people. These are people with like medical, you know, professional degrees that got high scores and all their standardized tests. And that's like, that's awful math. You know, it's the same people in the survey. I was just blown away by that. I guess that's why the servicers offer the refinancing companies like are willing to offer the cashback bonuses. And that's certainly one of the reasons that we do, is because it does seem to make a difference in people going through and actually searching for a rate. Like really the real reason you should be searching is to get a better interest rate because it makes sense to pay it off. But I find so few people actually know that you can refinance multiple times, and you know, you can refinance twice, three, four times, and it's really, you're getting a cash bonus to do it if that is what you need to do. I don't know. I thought that was an interesting little tidbit.
It's fascinating. I think people have a certain like kind of activation energy they need to get that reaction going. And so I think people's inertia is pretty high. And so something abstract like an interest rate is kind of hard for them to really do the actual math on. But a big, you know, one-time upfront bonus is very easy for everyone to understand. And yeah, I think people tend to overweight that bonus a lot. But, you know, it's a real thing. And if it gets them to be more diligent, I guess that's not a bad thing. But yeah, it's one of the funny things where, you know, the first step from refinancing a federal loan is a huge step. After that, you know, go hog wild, right? They're all the same. There's no reason to be worried about it then.
I think if I also asked that same question as to like how many people believe that a refinanced loan is a private loan, I think I'd get a lot of people saying it's not, but it obviously is.
Right.
You know, it's the exact same thing as any kind of private loan. It's just a loan that you refinance. That's the only difference. And if enough of our readers refinance their loans every 2 or 3 months where it becomes a problem and I get in trouble, because obviously these refinancing companies are partners of ours, then yeah, you know, okay, then we'll maybe have to change the bonuses or take them away or whatever. But not nearly enough people are doing that. I mean, I suggest that once somebody's already refinanced, you should be looking for new rates every 6 months. Yeah. Maybe that's a little bit too much, maybe once a year, but certainly like seems like the inertia is like unbelievable with refinancing. Like you can lock in a 5.5% rate for a 10-year and you could be getting a 4% rate for a 10-year and you would stick with that higher rate for like a year or two. It's just, I don't know, it's just mind blowing. Like just a quick personal story. Like I went to this presentation once by this portfolio manager for a mortgage securities fund, and the whole return of his fund was based off of if people were going to hold their mortgages or prepay them down when you were able to refinance, you know, and get a lower interest rate on your mortgage. And basically what he found was that people like mathematically, like 1,000% of the time should have refinanced their mortgage, like a huge percentage of them just didn't. And so he's sitting there collecting like way higher income than he's anticipating based on his math models. He's just like, wow, people just really like giving away free money to banks.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, you know, as you're making progress, right, you can usually get a lower rate by going to a shorter term, right? But everyone keeps their original rate from their original term, even once they've already multiple years into that term. It doesn't make any sense, right? This is a zero cost refinance. There's no fees, there's no overhead. So, you know, really, every time the rates go down or every time your situation changes, you should at least do a quick look to make sure. And whenever I get an alert saying that, you know, the LIBOR is down, I always check. Takes me 5 minutes, right? But it makes a huge difference, right? So, you know, over time, if you're able to go from a 10-year to a 7-year to a 5-year to a variable, you know, whatever, each time you do that, just by the fact that the term is lower, even if the rates were otherwise comparable, you'll get a better rate because you're going to have a lower term.
Yeah. Yeah. We call that the student loan refinancing ladder. We're trying to come up with all these terms so that, you know, these concepts can be boiled down, right? So we did breadwinner loophole, reverse breadwinner loophole, you know, refinancing ladder,
You got good branding. I need to get some more good verbiage when I write about this.
I know. Well, hopefully we can help popularize these things. So, you know, maybe I don't know what the double consolidation would be called. Maybe the send your kids to college for nothing, or the free college for kids loophole, or something like that. Yeah, I don't know.
The ham-fisted paper extravaganza.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, amending old returns. I don't know what you call that. Maybe should be fraud but isn't rule.
Right, sneaky tax man rule. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds
we'll
of
think
things.
About it.
Yeah, there's all kinds of things. Yeah, we really got to start trademarking these and start licensing them, right? But so interesting finding too from another survey we did, 15% was the income level that you would need to set your IDR payments at to get probably enough people above and below, like, that would refinance it if it was 15, but they would keep it on the federal system if it was 10. So it was interesting, right? Because, like, basically very few people would be willing to pay a 20% tax forever to have no student loans right now. And it was kind of your average number was 15% in terms of what people would be willing to pay in taxes to have no student loans. And then for Democrats, that number was actually, it was 15% for Democrats. It was like 12.5% overall, which is basically the Trump plan, right? 30 right. years, 12.5% of your income. And then Republicans, it was 10%. So one thing that I think that will happen is your, you know, a lot of these talks are doing, most of the reform I've seen from the Democrats and from the Senate Republicans has all been 10% of your income for 20 years with no tax bomb at the end. And the Republicans plan, I think, was the most generous of all, actually, the one from Senator Alexander, because it was 10% of your income directly from your paycheck and didn't include your spouse, which means that, you know, you could go hog wild with like S corporations, right? Paying yourself $120,000, even though you're making way more than that, pay 10% of that. So I don't know. I mean, it's interesting because the 20% number makes sense why so few people signed up for ICR, right? ICR was around since the 90s, but you didn't hear about anybody signing up for that because nobody in their right mind wants to trade 20% of their income for no student loans. But 15% seems to attract a lot of people, and 10% even attracts anti-tax Republicans. So what do you think about the future of loan policy? Do you think it is as straightforward as trying to figure out what that tax rate's going to be in exchange for no, you know, no student loans?
You know, I think that may be the way it works out, if only because it's easy to talk about. And I think the more complicated stuff becomes a little bit more difficult. I don't think the people who are discussing these issues really have thought it through that well, right? Because every time you say, oh, that's perfect, I can use that, it's like, well, maybe that's not what they meant, right? And I find that usually what happens with these, especially Republican proposals, is that the CBO will weigh in and be like, by the way, what you're saying is going to happen is not going to happen. We're like, no, it's going to be fine with like the tax cuts and whatnot. And so I think maybe magic number may help, but I do think that we probably will see any new policy with that kind of coupled with a change to the direct loan program in general, just because I do think that everyone in Congress realizes that we can't just keep saying we'll pay whatever the schools ask us to pay, no matter how much that is, with no family testing, no means testing, no educational verification as to costs, no requirements as to how much of an endowment they spend on tuition, you know, all that stuff, right? We've kind of let them do whatever they want to do. I think everyone's kind of aware that that's not really working out for the country. And even if you were to, you know, have a tax program that kind of dealt with the issue kind of on the back end, probably have to deal with the front end too.
Yeah, I think you'll probably see some sort of, I think even progressives will come around to the idea of having some sort of cap, because I think the concern that progressives have is, okay, maybe underrepresented folks are going to have lower test scores, perhaps. So yeah, I just think that we'll have a situation where, you know, you have a lot of these easiest to get in schools are the people that take the lowest, like the people with the worst scores in a lot of cases, right? And so if you did set a low cap, then that would make it really difficult for some folks to get in to fields like dentistry or medicine that are underrepresented. So I don't know. I think at some point you do have a cap. And do you think the interest rate's going to change in federal loans, or do you think they're just going to keep it really high?
I've kind of wondered about that. I think, you know, overall right now, because anyone can get a loan, kind of no matter what field they're going into, where they're going to school, how much money their family has, that's why they're so high, because the default rate is so high. So I think unless they change the underwriting process or the lack thereof, or they change the overall amounts a person can borrow to be much lower than they are right now, they don't change those two things, they'll probably stay high, because that's the only way the money works out.
Yep. So let's talk about if somebody does not have the resources to hire a student loan planner to figure out their loans, what should they be doing if they have a lot of time on their hands?
Well, there are a lot of things they could do. I think the one thing I'd recommend them do is to try to find a place where you can learn about the topic kind of in an A to Z fashion, get a comprehensive view of the field. One of the good ways to do that, maybe the best way, who's to say, I'm kind of biased, is to read one of the two books that I wrote about this subject a few years ago and have been updating ever since. So if you go to benwhite.com/studentloans, you can download one or two of the versions of my book. One is called Medical Student Loans and one is called Dealing with Student Loans. So the former is for doctors and the latter is for everybody else, lawyers, teachers, dentists, et cetera, because they don't have the residency and some of the kind of more confounding aspects of medical training to deal with. You can buy those books, you know, on Amazon or Apple. You can pay me for them, but you can also just get them for free. And so I think those are good ways to kind of get a comprehensive view. Pretty much everything you could want to know about that topic is in the book. I can't hold your hand and tell you what to do. I'm not going to run your numbers for you. But in terms of giving you the tools you need to succeed, they're all in there.
Yeah, I mean, that's I think all you can ask for is if you want to press the easy button and you want somebody that knows what they're talking about, there's options out there for that for people that can pay. And if you can't afford to pay, then like most things in life, it's going to take you time to do things if you don't have the money to hire somebody to do it for you, right? So yeah. I think that, you know, for probably a half day to a day, you could sit down and read your book and kind of have a pretty good understanding of what's going to happen and probably have a, you might make some mistakes, but probably you won't if you really pay attention and you're smart and you take notes and things like that. But that's one of the reasons I wanted you to mention that is because I think your books are really excellent and they're probably, you know, outside of reading like some long blog posts on the topic, they're probably one of the best resources out there. So thank you for sharing that, Ben.
Of course, yeah.
Last point. So you think no tax bomb, that's what we're settling for the 25-year people that are going for forgiveness. You think there's not going to be any tax bomb?
I think that's definitely a possibility. I would still have a tax bomb slush fund. I would still make sure to save for retirement as aggressively as possible to at least make up for the fact that you might not be able to do so when you get closer to tax bomb time. But I definitely think there's a good chance it'll work out in borrower's favor because I think the insolvency issue by itself will kind of force this to a head no matter what.
Any loopholes that I missed?
I don't think so. I think we covered all of
them. I'll probably remember some later that I forgot.
Well, we did discuss the whole, you know, repay, pay as you earn, where one couple files joint, one couple files separate, you know, that whole thing. But that's not worth getting into. What a mess.
That's probably another podcast episode, probably.
Seriously.
Yeah. But thanks so much. So benwhite.com, folks. Ben, thanks so much for being on the show.
My pleasure.